All right, I told you mostly about slide 18, but I seem to remember telling you there are three lobes. Did I say that?
Yeah.
Nonsense. There's four lobes. There's two big ones, and I said there's a smaller one that you can see from the inferior called the caudate lobe, but there's another smaller one as well between the left and right from the inferior view, and that's the quadrate lobe. So those are the major subdivisions of the overall liver. As we'll see, each lobe is internally separated into much smaller subunits called lobules. While we're here, though, I also wanted to say something more about the vessels. We talked about the porta hepatis, and all the green tubes here, which we'll talk about in closer detail in a different slide, are conducting, first of all, bile rather than blood. And those are conducting that bile out of the liver, away from the liver. Whereas both the red and the blue here, which are conducting blood, are bringing blood into the liver. This is because of the portal system, right? The blue one is bringing blood into the liver because it's a portal vein transporting blood that it received from the gut, small intestine, but also stomach and spleen and the digestive tract as a whole, basically, emptying into the liver first. That's why what would normally be, you would think of a blood vessel carrying blood away from the liver if it was colored blue, right? This is bringing blood into the liver. And of course, the red one is bringing blood into the liver, but from a different route. That's fully oxygenated blood that's coming from the heart. Without going to the gut first. On the other hand, notice the inferior vena cava, which the liver kind of wraps partially around. And you don't see the connection here. It looks like just the inferior vena cava is resting right next to the liver, but it's actually receiving a bunch of veins from the liver, emptying directly into the inferior vena cava. So that's how blood is drained from the liver, directly into the inferior vena cava. The blood vessels at the porta hepatis are all inputs of blood into the liver. Okay? Now let's go on to 19 and look at the interior structure of the lobules that I mentioned. So the lobules, you know, there's millions of lobules. They're tiny. We're looking at a close-up cartoon version of just mostly one lobule here, but you see some surrounding lobules as well. Each individual lobule, and it's the same in all four lobes, so the lobes don't specialize in their jobs. They're just major subdivisions. But the lobules within the lobes, these tiny ones, are roughly hexagonal in shape, as you can see here. And that's because that's, you know, when you take a hexagons, you can fit them together without any spaces in between them. And so at the corners of these hexagons where multiple lobules meet each other, you have what are called hepatic triads. Now, a triad is just a general word for a three-part thing, right? So the three components to any given hepatic triad, as you see here, there is a branch, the blue one, the blue component is a branch of the hepatic portal vein. So the hepatic portal vein is a big vein outside of the liver, bringing blood that is partially deoxygenated but also rich in nutrients because it's coming from the gut, bringing that blood into the liver. That's not what we're looking at here. We're looking at a tiny branch of that after it has already entered the liver. So there's millions of branches of the hepatic portal vein. Each one is one member of a hepatic triad. The red member is a branch of the hepatic artery. That's the artery that's bringing fresh oxygenated blood directly, more directly from the heart without going to a capillary bed first. All right? So those two obviously are both bringing blood into the lobules. The green one is a branch or not a branch, a tributary to what eventually will bring bile out of the liver. So this is a bile ductule, which simply means a small duct, and it's receiving bile from what are called bile canaliculi. All right? Bile canaliculi, meaning little canals, are blind-ended. They don't have... It's not a closed system. It's not a circuit, is what I should say. By blind-ended, meaning they just end, but really it's not an end. It's a beginning in terms of the flow of stuff through them. Okay, so the pink cells here are hepatocytes, the major type of cell that's in a liver, that makes up the liver itself. And hepatocytes do various functions. We've talked about the many jobs of the liver. The digestive function of the liver is to produce bile. And so the bile created and secreted from these hepatocytes makes its way into the bile canaliculi. There are many, many of these bile canaliculi. And as more and more bile enters the bile canaliculi, it accumulates in the bile ductules, which then converge into bigger and bigger tubes within the liver until finally it exits through a couple of major bile conducting vessels that we'll look at in a different slide. That's taking it all the way out of the liver. All right? So the bile ductules are all, they're carrying different stuff compared to the other ones in the triad. They're carrying bile instead of blood, and they're carrying that out of the liver, whereas the red and blue one are carrying blood instead of bile, and those are all bringing blood into the lobules. Now, each individual lobule at its center features what's called a central vein. And radiating in all directions from that central vein are sheets of these hepatocytes. Okay? The hepatocytes are the liver cells, like I said. And then if we look at the arrangement on the bottom of these hepatocytes, we can see that they form spaces lined by endothelial cells. The purple ones are endothelial cells. Well, those endothelial cells are blood vessel cells, really, because these spaces are sinusoids. And remember that sinusoids are a type of capillary, right? So the collection of all these sinusoids in all these millions of lobules within the overall liver, those make up the second capillary bed that makes this whole thing a portal system. The first capillary bed surrounds the small intestine, the stomach, the spleen, and the pancreas. All of those blood vessels collectively make up the first capillary bed. That drains blood from those structures into bigger and bigger veins, which eventually become the hepatic portal vein, bringing all of that nutrient-filled blood into the liver. And then once it's inside the liver, it branches many, many times into all of these branches of the hepatic portal vein at the various triads. All right, that's bringing the blood in. It's already gone through one capillary bed. After it leaves the branch of the hepatic portal vein, notice that each hepatic portal vein branch in a triad and branch of the hepatic artery in the triad branch even further, but those branches converge into the sinusoids. So this is an interesting place in the body because you have a mixture of two different kinds of blood coming into that second capillary bed. The blood that's rich in oxygen from the hepatic artery mixes with the blood that's lower in oxygen but rich in nutrients from the first capillary bed to make up all of these sinusoids that are the second capillary bed in the portal system. Does that all make sense? Okay, so as blood trickles through these sinusoids, nutrients get absorbed by the liver. The portal system makes the liver the first stop for the nutrients that get absorbed by the small intestine. Mostly it's the small intestine that does the absorption. So hepatocytes absorb a bunch of glucose, which is the primary digested sugar, amino acids from the proteins that you ate. The proteins don't get absorbed, but the amino acids do after the proteins are digested. Minerals, drugs, various things that you've eaten basically come by way of the hepatic portal system into the liver. And the liver deals with those things in various ways. For instance, it takes in extra glucose right after a meal and makes glycogen out of the glucose for storage until later on when you're low in glucose again because you haven't eaten in a while. Then it reverses the process, breaks the glycogen down, spills the glucose out into the blood, and keeps a steady state for the steady glucose level in the blood for the brain. That's a major function of the liver. Something I was just going to say. Well, that'll probably come back. These endothelial cells that line these sinusoids, notice, are very leaky, as you'd expect sinusoids to be. They're the leakiest of the capillaries. And so that's why various things so easily get absorbed into the hepatocytes. If the endothelial cells formed an impenetrable barrier, then the blood being put into these sinusoids would not be able to put anything into the liver cells themselves, the hepatocytes. So the endothelial lining of the sinusoids is very leaky. Okay, now this is happening in all of these millions of lobules, but all of these sinusoids in one lobule, notice, converge into the central vein of that lobule. That central vein is still tiny because these lobules are tiny. But there's a central vein for each lobule. Those central veins then converge into bigger veins, which then converge into bigger veins still. And eventually, the biggest veins in the liver, which are the hepatic veins, empty directly into the inferior vena cava. And then it goes to the heart. So the portal system is complete because the sinusoids themselves make up the second capillary bed. Now to 20. Here we get a good look at the pancreas, which is an accessory organ for digestion. It's actually anatomically a member of both the digestive system and what other system? The endocrine system, that's right, because it is a gland that is both endocrine and exocrine. What are the endocrine secretions? The major ones? The major hormones of the pancreas are what? We've talked about this already. No idea? Insulin and glucagon, which are important for regulating blood glucose levels, right? That's not the digestive function of the pancreas. It's a very important function. That's the endocrine function. That's taken care of by what kind of cells in the pancreas? What are the endocrine cells exist as? Islets, pancreatic islets. And those islets, all of them combined, make up very, very little of the stuff of the pancreas. By far, most of the cells of the pancreas are part of the exocrine portion of the gland. And what makes it exocrine? Any given exocrine gland is exocrine by virtue of what?
Ducts,
yes. So that's not true of the islets, right? The islets produce their hormones, and that gets those hormones get picked up by the bloodstream. The rest of it, which is by far most of the secretions, get secreted into ducts that converge into bigger and bigger ducts until finally those secretions are released from the pancreas proper and into the alimentary canal. The pancreas is not part of the alimentary canal, that's why it's an accessory organ, but it connects to the alimentary canal, and its exocrine secretions get delivered to the alimentary canal, specifically at the duodenum. The duodenum, remember, is the first part of the three sections that make up the small intestine, And so the stomach has been cut away here, but the stomach would connect directly to the duodenum which sphincter? The gatekeeper, what is that called? The pyloric sphincter, right, which would be about in this position. It's just that the stomach's been removed so you can see the pancreas better. Well, that very first part of the duodenum forms a hairpin loop. And right in that hairpin loop is where you'll find what is called the head of the pancreas. Right in that hairpin loop. And then the head gives rise to the body. Finally, you have the tail at the left end. In people that aren't reversed. So the tail's over there. Well, we're seeing a cutaway view of the pancreas here. And so the vast majority of the cells in this pancreas that are not the islets, that is, are busy making the exocrine secretions, which collectively are called pancreatic juice. So the overall name for the exocrine secretion of the pancreas is pancreatic juice. That does not include the hormones, which are the endocrine secretion released into the bloodstream. Notice that there are many tributaries to what is called the pancreatic duct, a major duct that carries this pancreatic juice through the length of the pancreas. But at the end of the line, in terms of flow of pancreatic juice, where the pancreas connects to the duodenum, there is a convergence of two different tubes and a swelling of that overall anatomy. That swelling is called the the major duodenal papilla. The papilla is like any papilla, a finger-like projection toward the inner surface of the duodenum. The swelling formed by the convergence of the two tubes is an ampulla, which means little vessel. It's specifically called the hepatopancreatic ampulla because the two tubes that converge to make that ampulla are one from the pancreas and one from the liver. Hepato means liver. Pancreatic, of course, refers to pancreas. Okay, so let's talk about this green member of the two things converging here. The liver is not shown either, but at the porta hepatis, remember I said the green tubes are bringing bile out of the liver. So all those bile canaliculi trickle into bile ductules, which then converge from the lobules into bigger and bigger bile-carrying vessels that eventually exit the liver as two major bile-conducting tubes called hepatic ducts, right and left hepatic ducts. Now, they are called hepatic ducts because they are directly connected to the liver, receiving bile directly from the liver. The liver produces the bile, right? The hepatic ducts then converge into one tube called the common hepatic duct, not because it's run-of-the-mill, but because it has those other bile ducts in common, right? They empty into it. So now you have one tube coming from the liver, the common hepatic duct, and it is then joined by a convergence from a tube coming from the gallbladder itself. All right. Now that gallbladder's tube, it's the tube that's coming directly from the gallbladder, is the cystic duct, which makes sense because, remember, the gallbladder can also be called the cholecyst, the bile bag. So the cystic duct is carrying bile from the gallbladder, the common hepatic duct from the liver. Those two then converge into what is called the bile duct, or some books will call it the common bile duct. The reason it's called bile duct is because it, rather than being named for an organ, is because it can be carrying bile from either the gallbladder or the liver. All right? It's that bile duct that then penetrates the surface of the pancreas and joins with the very end of the pancreatic duct inside the gland to form this hepatopancreatic ampulla. Therefore, hepatopancreatic ampulla contains a mixture of bile and pancreatic juice, both of which are digestive, important for digestion. All right? Now, this ampulla is right where the tubing connects to the duodenum. And therefore, that's how pancreatic juice and bile, a combination of the two, get delivered into the duodenum. But the body needs to be able to control when that mixture of fluids gets put into the duodenum. And therefore, at this papilla, you have a sphincter, which is the hepatopancreatic ampullar sphincter, named for where it is. Okay? And only when that sphincter relaxes is the mixture of bile and pancreatic juice delivered to the lumen of the duodenum. Notice, though, that upstream of the ampulla, there's actually a branch, at least in most people, of the pancreatic duct, and that branch goes directly to what's called the minor duodenal papilla, because it's a little smaller, and it's carrying only pancreatic juice. So this is a way to bypass the mixture with bile, and therefore, with its own sphincter, under the operation of its own sphincter, pancreatic juice can be delivered to the duodenum without bile also being delivered. So, by the way, the bile that's produced by the liver, more or less continuously being produced, collected by the bile canaliculi into bigger and bigger vessels till it exits the liver at the right and left hepatic ducts. The bile trickles through the hepatic ducts into the common hepatic duct and then into the bile duct. Now we're assuming that the sphincter down at the hepatopancreatic ampulla is closed. All right, so that bile will fill up the bile duct coming straight from the liver. Once it fills up the bile duct, there's still bile coming out of the liver. It just doesn't have anywhere to go at this point, considering this sphincter is closed. So that's actually when it starts backing up through the cystic duct to fill up the gallbladder. All right. Once it's in the gallbladder, though, the gallbladder actually changes, concentrates the bile by removing water. So it concentrates it quite a bit, actually. And that's where most of the bile is temporarily held until it gets the signal for its need in digestion to be released into the duodenum. And that signal causes relaxation of the hepatopancreatic ampullar sphincter, allowing bile along with pancreatic juice to enter the duodenum. Okay, now to 21, we're looking at the histology of the exocrine portion of the pancreas here. The glands of the exocrine glands of the pancreas are acinar in shape, and they lead to ducts, of course, since they're exocrine. These acinar cells, well, let me just say that pancreatic juice is itself a mixture. Pancreatic juice gets mixed with bile, but when it's just pancreatic juice, it's already a mixture of bicarbonate ions, enzymes, and zymogens, mostly, and water, of course. Well, the acinar cells at the blind end of these glands are responsible for making the enzymes and zymogens. What are zymogens, by the way? Yes, they are something. Yeah, that's the gen ending. What's the zyme part indicate? Enzymes, right. Zymogens are proenzymes because they have to be changed in order to actually make the active form of the enzyme. So there's different zymogens, there are different enzymes. These are made by the acinar cells and released. Notice that they accumulate first as zymogen granules. Zymogen granules are really just vesicles containing these zymogens and enzymes, and they are at the ready, waiting for the signal to be released by exocytosis into the duct. All right? The endothelial cells that make up the lining of the duct itself are the ones that are mostly responsible for producing the bicarbonate ions. So the acinar cells specialize in the proteins, the zymogens and the enzymes, and the duct cells specialize in producing the bicarbonate ions. Now, why would you have bicarbonate ions as an important component of pancreatic juice? Right, bicarbonate ions can neutralize acidity. And notice where the pancreatic juice is being delivered into the duodenum, right? The very first part of the small intestine. So it's receiving, the duodenum, that is receiving chyme from the stomach directly, which means that chyme is going to be very acidic because of the hydrochloric acid in the stomach. The enzymes that take over the job of digestion from the stomach, which, like I said, the stomach doesn't really do all that much digestion, chemical digestion. Most of the digestion by far occurs in the small intestine. But anyway, the enzymes responsible for taking over that chemical digestion job work at an optimum pH that's much higher, is neutral compared to the enzymes that operate in the stomach, the pepsin that I've talked about. So that chyme needs to undergo an increase in pH, a decrease in acidity, in other words, toward neutrality. The bicarbonate ion portion of the pancreatic juice achieves that neutralization of the acid. The zymogens and enzymes, obviously, are going to be important for the chemical digestion. So in 22, we can see some of that. Here we're assuming that the stomach has released chyme, at least a little bit of its chyme, because it squirts a little chyme out as it churns. Doesn't release all of its contents at once into the small intestine, but little by little, the pyloric sphincter allows a little bit of chyme from the stomach to enter the small intestine. And in response to that, the hepatopancreatic ampullar sphincter relaxes, allowing for bile and pancreatic juice to come in here. Now, bile is not shown here, but let me just say that an important component of bile, which contains not just digestively important components, it also contains a lot of waste materials from the liver. So it's appropriate to put that waste into the lumen of the digestive tract as well, because it'll become part of the residue that will eventually be eliminated as feces. But digestively, an important component of bile are bile acids. And that helps for emulsification of fats. We'll talk more about that in a different slide. That's happening at the same time, because remember, the bile duct converges with the pancreatic duct here. But all we care about in this slide, that's why the bile duct isn't shown here, all we care about really is what's happening from the pancreas. So the zymogens that these pancreatic acinar cells make are of three types. We see them listed here. Trypsinogen, chymotrypsinogen, and carboxypeptidase. Okay? Or I'm sorry, procarboxypeptidase. Those are all zymogens. They're not enzymes yet. They are the precursor proteins that can get turned into the enzymes themselves. Okay? Now, trypsinogen obviously is named for the fact that it can get turned into trypsin. Chymotrypsinogen can be turned into chymotrypsin, and even though we don't use the gen ending for the other one, it's also a zymogen. Procarboxypeptidase means before carboxypeptidase. So it can get turned into carboxypeptidase. All three of these are enzymes for the digestion of what kind of nutrient? Anyone know? Well, what about, what does the name tell you? This third name especially. Proteins, right, the peptidase. Protease and peptidase really mean the same thing. They are, it's a class of enzymes that digestively hydrolyze proteins. They break peptide bonds. So these, all three of these, though, even though they don't all have pept in the name, all three of these, trypsin, chymotrypsin, and carboxypeptidase, they are all proteases. So, as I was telling you before, and for the stomach, peptidases are dangerous things to have in cells, right? Because they degrade they don't care what protein they're degrading, including the proteins that make up the cell itself. That's why these things are not made by the cell directly as trypsin, chymotrypsin, and carboxypeptidase. And the cell is therefore not exposed to these protein-degrading enzymes. Instead, they're made as zymogens, which then, after they've been released from the cells of the pancreas, get converted into the enzymes themselves, the proteases. So what you're seeing here is that a combination of all three zymogens gets released as components of the pancreatic juice. The lining of the duodenum, these brown cells are the endothelial cells of the duodenum, they produce an enzyme called enterokinase. All right? The enterokinase has the effect of transforming trypsinogen, which is the zymogen, into trypsin, the actual protein-degrading enzyme. Trypsin not only starts digesting proteins from the food, but these zymogens themselves are proteins. So trypsin can convert trypsinogen into chymotrypsin, and it can convert procarboxypeptidase into carboxypeptidase, because they are they are proteins, right? Makes sense that trypsin would work that way. But also, trypsin is autocatalytic because trypsinogen is also a protein. So once you have a little bit of that converted by enterokinase into trypsin, trypsin will turn more trypsinogen into more trypsin. And therefore, the zymogens all get converted into enzymes, proteolytic enzymes, or proteases, or peptidases. Those all really mean the same thing, protein-degrading enzymes. Now, these are not the only enzymes that came from the pancreas. These are just the enzymes that come from the pancreas in zymogen form rather than in fully active form. The pancreas also releases enzymes that specialize in degrading the other kinds of nutrients besides proteins. Well, we can see some of that in slide 23 in the table that lists these important pancreatic secretions. All right, I talked about sodium carbonate already. Bicarbonate. The bicarbonate ions neutralize the hydrochloric acid from the stomach. Those, like I said, come chiefly from the cells that make up the lining of the ducts, but it's still part of the pancreatic juice. The rest of it comes from those acinar cells at the blind ends of those acinar-shaped ducts. Glands. So the zymogens are listed here. I just went over that. The enzymes are listed separately because these ones come out of the cells unmodified. They don't have to be modified. The cell makes them as fully active enzymes right away. And those include another form of amylase, pancreatic amylase. So where else did we have amylase? In the mouth. Salivary amylase starts the process of digesting starch, right? Remember, amylose means starch. Starch is most of the digestible carbohydrate that you take in as food. Starches are the digestible polysaccharides. Now, you take in both storage and structural polysaccharides in your diet, right? Cellulose, you take in a lot of that as well. Cellulose is also pure glucose stuck together, but stuck together in a different way. And we don't have the enzymes necessary to break those bonds, those glycosidic bonds between the glucoses within cellulose, which is why cellulose is indigestible. It's not that it doesn't have any energy in it. It's chock full of energy because it's chock full of glucose. We just can't exploit the energy. So that gets just passed, never enters the body, never gets broken down in the alimentary canal. It just becomes part of the residue passed through as feces. That's what we call roughage. So that's indigestible polysaccharides. The digestible polysaccharides, mostly starch from the food you eat. You take in, if you eat animals, you take in a little bit of the animal's version of storage polysaccharide, which is what? What's our version? We don't make starch, but instead make what? Glycogen. It's very little, though, because the glycogen is just very little in the diet. Well, anyway, glycogen can also be broken down by amylase. Well, yes, that does start out in the mouth because you have salivary amylase. The salivary amylase enzymes get degraded easily, though, by the acidic environment of the stomach. So it starts in the mouth, pauses, and then resumes in the duodenum because a member of the pancreatic juice, a component of the pancreatic juice, is pancreatic amylase. Works the same way. Now the pH has been restored to neutral, though, because of the bicarbonate ions. So the rest of the starch, that about half of it gets digested in the stomach, even though the stomach is acidic, until that stomach really needs that bolus of food that you've swallowed up, a lot of that starch and salivary amylase can be in the middle of the bolus where it really hasn't been exposed to the acid yet. Only until sufficient churning has exposed the amylase to the starch does it actually disable the amylase. By then, you've digested about half of the starch in that food, that chyme in the stomach, but then the rest of it gets digested in the duodenum because of pancreatic amylase. There's also pancreatic lipase. Lipases, of course, degrade lipids, and the primary lipid from food are fats. Where else did we have lipase? The stomach, and where else? And the mouth. We have lingual lipase, remember, that starts its digestion of fat but doesn't do too much of a good job in the mouth. The lingual lipase is activated by the acidity of the stomach, and so it kicks it into gear. But the stomach adds its own gastric lipase. Those both degrade fats. Well, it's continued in the duodenum because of pancreatic juices, pancreatic lipase. So the three major nutrient classes, there's four overall biological macromolecules, right? Three of them are major nutrient classes, which are polysaccharides, proteins, and lipids. The fourth one that is also a macromolecule class are, of course, the nucleic acids. And you do take in nucleic acids, of course. When you eat cells, you're eating DNA and RNA. It's just that the amount of DNA and RNA is very small compared to the amount of all the other three. But they have to be broken down if they're going to be used as building blocks. So that's why pancreatic juice also has nucleases and deoxyribonucleases. Ribonucleases, I should say, and deoxyribonucleases, which are responsible for degrading RNA and DNA, respectively. By the way, when you break down a nucleic acid, but when you digest it with a nuclease, which both of these are nucleases, what do you produce? When you disassemble a nucleic acid with a nuclease, what are you left with as building blocks? Nucleotides. Now, nucleotides themselves are then broken down by nucleotidases. And so each nucleotide, even though it is a building block, is actually three things in itself, right? A sugar, a phosphate, and a nitrogenous base. So those all actually get disassembled in the digestive tract as well, just not from these nucleases, but instead by nucleotidases. And once they're in those three components, then those get absorbed into the bloodstream. Okay, 24. We have been already talking about the small intestine, but really just the beginning of the small intestine, the duodenum, named for the fact that its length is about equal to 12 average human finger widths. Duoden means 2-10 or 12. Well, that's really a very short part of the overall length of the small intestine. The small intestine, remember, is named for its diameter. That's what's small compared to the large intestine. Its length is much longer than the large intestine. In an average human, about 5 meters. And that's when you're alive. It's much longer than that when you lose the muscle tone and it stretches a lot farther in the cadaver. But 5 meters is a long distance. That great length, all coiled up in the abdominal cavity, is one of the reasons why the chyme gets a good chance at being exposed to the enzymes of digestion that are being secreted by some cells and that actually are bound to the plasma membranes of other cells. Just the fact that it's long length means that the chyme gets a good chance at being exposed to enzymes. But as we'll see, that chance gets greatly increased by how the interior anatomy is arranged. Anyway, there are three major sections, one after another, to the small intestine, and you don't really see, well, at least in one case, a clear boundary between them all. But the duodenum ends after, like I said, about 12 finger widths, and it gives rise to the second section, which is called the jejunum, the part that is violet in this picture. Of course, that's not how it really appears. It's not really that color. The jejunum gets its name, it means empty. And that's really just because early anatomists were carving on dead people that weren't, you know, they didn't have a full gut. So it looked empty. But the jejunum is actually, of course, sometimes it's empty, but when there's chyme coming through it, which is often, it is actually where most of the digestion and absorption takes place. A lot of it starts in the duodenum, but the jejunum is much longer than the duodenum, and that's where anything that hasn't been broken down into the smallest subunits yet will eventually be broken down in the jejunum and absorbed by the endothelial cells that line the jejunum. So the jejunum, even though it means empty, not really empty, it has a thicker wall, a more muscular wall, than the third part that it gives rise to after a certain length. So about, if you remove the duodenum, which is not very long, and then consider just the rest of the small intestine, about 40% of the rest of that large intestine is the jejunum, and then the other 60% of the rest of the small intestine is the final or third section, which is called the ileum, which you should be careful with spelling-wise, because there's ileum with an E here, that's a digestive system structure, and there's ileum with an I, right, which is what? Ileum is one of the bones of the os coxa, right? Ileum, ischium, and pubis, those are bones, not digestive system structures. Okay, well, anyway, that's the final part, and it's much thinner-walled, much less muscular, which is kind of how you can tell it when you dissect a human from the jejunum, basically just its texture. It's also not as highly vascularized, and therefore it's not as pink if you're looking at a living one. But anyway, it's the third in line. So it's the end of the ileum is the end of the small intestine, and that small intestine empties directly into the large intestine. Well, the very first part of the large intestine is an enlarged pouch-like part called the cecum. So we're looking into the cecum here. And that's where the connection with the small intestine is made, and it's the ileum is that last part. And therefore, the actual boundary between small and large intestine is the ileocecal valve, named for the ileum and the cecum, where they come together. And the ileocecal valve features a sphincter, so that the passage of chyme from the small intestine into the large intestine can be regulated, and also so that once the chyme gets put into the large intestine, in which case we rename it to feces, that the feces can't be inadvertently put back into the small intestine. So it keeps it as a one-way passage. Okay? Well, that we'll talk more about the large intestine in a bit, but well, not today, but we will next time. Anyway, let's talk more about the small intestine's lining. This is slide 25. I said that one part of the reason why the chyme gets such a good chance at being exposed to digestive enzymes is because the small intestine is pretty long. But despite being long, if it just had a smooth interior, an endothelium that is smooth, there would be a lot of chyme that would never actually be exposed to the enzymes that are on the plasma membranes of the endothelial cells lining the small intestine. They have to come into some of the enzymes that we've been talking about, well, all of the enzymes that we've been talking about so far, are actually secreted into the lumen and therefore get mixed up with the chyme. So they would get a chance, at least, to be exposed to the chyme. But a lot of the enzymes that do the final bit of digestion that will break, for instance, an oligopeptide, very short sequence of amino acids, finally into individual amino acids, and similarly for the other polymers, those enzymes are not actually secreted and released from the cells. They are part of the plasma membrane. They're membrane-bound enzymes facing the exterior of the cell and therefore facing the lumen of the small intestine. And therefore, for them to work, the chyme has to be brought to them and come in contact with it, which is why it's really important for the chyme not to just go through the small intestine, but on its way be mixed up and roll around. Otherwise, you could have a bunch of nutrients in the interior of a peg of chyme that never gets exposed to these digestive enzymes, and therefore those nutrients would be wasted. They would be passed as feces and never absorbed by the small intestine. That's why the lining of the small intestine is not smooth, but it features prominent folds in the interior called circular folds. And some books will call these plice circularis, P-L-I-C-A-E is one word, circularis, which simply means circular folds. So these are major folds. You can, if you just opened up the overall small intestine, you would see, instead of just being smooth, it has a bunch of folds in it. And they are transversely positioned, but not perfectly transversely. They're kind of diagonal, so that they really form kind of a spiral, like the metal coil in a dryer hose, in a sense, only folded much more into the interior of the hose rather than just being at the surface. So that means as chyme comes through, it hits these folds and gets tumbled and spiraled as it goes through the small intestine. This maximizes the chance that chyme that would be in the interior of a segment would get eventually exposed to those enzymes that are on the actual cells making up the epithelium, so that the final bit of digestion can take place. But these circular folds are also important. Not only do they tumble the chyme, they also, though, drastically increase the surface area beyond what it would be if it were just a smooth lining. That's one degree of amplification of the surface area. there are 3 degrees of amplification of the surface area, and that's where I'll, after I give you the three, that's where I'll end. So you have a circular fold. That is a macroscopic thing. You can easily see that. That's made up of millions of cells on it, okay? And so that would be just represented by a huge hill. That's a circular fold. This is the lumen of the gut, okay? On the surface, all along that circular fold are villi, which are little hills themselves. Each villus is a little finger-like projection. It's really a kind of another name for a papilla. All right? So, obviously, the surface area is going to be greatly increased because of the villi, rather than just being one smooth lining over the overall circular fold. Each villus is made up, is lined by many cells. And each cell itself has tiny microvilli, which are extensions of its own plasma membrane that stick out there. And the collection of all these microvilli make up what is called the brush border. It makes the lining fuzzy looking. Well, all three of those greatly increase the surface area. About 500 times more than it would be if you just had a smooth interior lining. And that greatly increases the chance of not only digestion by these membrane-bound enzymes, but absorption into those cells. All right, that's it.